So many of you are continuing to remember Barbara and me in our recent days, and we both thank you for that. Several of you have asked how my mom is doing. She's doing fine. I think the fact that the way this all played out, we already had her in a different place than the house she had lived in, and in a place where there were people that cared for her and that she's able to have interaction with has been a big help. Now, we started last week a new piece of work, and I need you to know that although I'm continuing to be aware that in a formal sense we're talking about lists that we find in the Bible, what we're going to be doing in the next little while, we're going to let the lists sort of go past us. There's going to be several today. I think I totaled up maybe as many as 15 will go running past us today. But I'm not putting the focus on the lists. I'm putting the focus on what's coming through these in this particular time. And we are working out of a little book of Hosea. Hosea is a book that in the Old Testament is considered to be part of what group of books? The prophets. In particular, the minor prophets. And they're called minor prophets not because they're unimportant or less important, but because short books. There are also major prophets called major prophets, not because they're more important, but because they are big books. And there are some prophets out there that didn't get a book. So Hosea is the first of the minor prophets, and maybe I gave you enough time to find that. You had an assignment this week. I spoke to somebody midweek, and that person said something that I thought was really interesting. That person said, you know, it was so much fun to do that assignment. This is the person who actually did it. Of course, if you didn't do it, you won't say it that way. And he said, I chose to do the reading of Hosea twice out of two different translations. And he said, I found out so much by watching how one translation worded something and then how another one worded it. And then there was a couple in the first hour that said the husband had read it out of one, the wife read it out of the other, and actually read it to each other. And so they would read a little bit out of one, read a little bit out of the other. And I commend that to you. If you don't have access to more than one translation, maybe this would be a good time to get that. I routinely read out of King James, NIV, New Living, and Message, in addition to the one that I usually read from in here, and try not to tell you what it is so you won't get that one, and you'll have something fresh to hear when you come in. Now, this particular week, we're coming off of having studied and looked at the first two chapters in Hosea. Actually, the first three. And what I want to do today is take you into chapter 4. But I cannot do that, I believe, until I first take you back to chapter 2 and let you see something. Because if you can see this clearly, then what you see in chapter 4 comes alive in a very powerful way. So I want you to take a look in Hosea. I think in your translation it will be verse 16, chapter 2. Hosea chapter 2, verse 16. And what I want you to notice is just the opening phrase. In my translation it says, when that day comes. Does yours have something like that? In that day, yours says. Okay. Take a look at verse 18. You should see the same opening phrase. Take a look at verse 21. You can see the same opening phrase. There's a big break between chapter 2, verse 15 and chapter 2, verse 16. Because in chapter 2, verse 16, all the problems that the Lord has been talking about through His prophet up to this point suddenly are set aside, and the prophet is led by God to start to hear God's words about the day when finally His people begin to respond to Him and what's going to happen in that time. Okay, so when that day comes means when my people finally begin to respond to me. Individually maybe, but more likely in groups. When the group begins to respond, then these are the things that are going to happen. When that day comes, declares the Lord, you will call me, that is, you will call God, my husband. No more will you call me my Baal. I will banish the names of the Baals from her lips, and their name will never be mentioned anymore. You may remember that the picture here is of a broken preacher whose marriage has fallen apart. And the preacher sees in that a relationship to how God's people and their relationship to God has fallen apart. And so the message is that God's people are to relate to God the way a wife is to relate to a husband in an ideal marriage. The word Baal there is important for you to know. That's the name of one or a group of idols or false gods that the people of Israel were worshiping. Sometimes the worship involves some pretty rough things, and we may see that in some things that we read in just a moment. But what that says is, when the day comes that I'm in right relationship with my people, idolatry will not be a problem. Things will not stand between my people and me. If you come to the New Testament, there's a couple of verses that says greed is idolatry. So don't think that if you're not putting up idols of stone and bowing down in front of them, idolatry is no longer a problem. In our day, it just takes a different form. Verse 18, when that day comes, I will make a treaty for them with the wild animals and the birds of heaven and the creeping things of the earth. I'll break the bow and the sword and warfare and banish them from the country. I will let them sleep secure. God says idolatry isn't going to be a problem when things are finally in right relationship between me and my people. And no longer will there be terrors either of nature or of other human beings. Peace, safety, security will be theirs. Now, verse 19 in your translation, I don't know how yours is wording this. This is one I didn't go back and look up. My translation says, I will betroth you to myself forever. And that phrase is speaking of the beginning of a marriage relationship. What does yours say at that point? Same thing. Okay. I will betroth you to myself forever. And it's the next little part that I want you to see. In my translation, it says, I will betroth you in this and this, and this and this. I will betroth you to myself in this and this. There's going to be a total of six of these, divided into groups of two. And I want to get those terms down so that you can see them. This is verse 19. I will betroth you to myself forever. I will betroth you in, my translation says, uprightness, justice. Looking only at those two terms, what other words do you have?
Righteousness.
So you still have justice for the second. Okay. You reading out of the message? That sounds like a... Okay.
I have a notation down at the bottom where it says, I will betroth you in righteousness. And the note says, you can also use, I will betroth you with righteousness.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, that's the first two. What are the second two? In my translation, it says faithful love and tenderness. Yours says love and compassion. Yours says love and mercy. There's at least one translation that has a different phrase there that went down the first hour.
Loving kindness and mercy.
Okay. Loving kindness and mercy. And I heard somebody else say the one that they got in the first hour.
Steadfast.
What does the word steadfast or faithful do in the modifier of that word? Puts some strength behind it, doesn't it? Okay. Before we go any further, I want you to be aware of that particular word, this word right here, or its translations as you have it in your translation. This is a Hebrew word that in English letters I've been taught to spell as H-E-S-E-D. And it's the Hebrew equivalent of a powerful word in the New Testament, the Greek word agape. Those of you who know something about the word agape, the Greek word in the New Testament, what does it mean? Right. God's kind of love, which I think underscores the importance of this particular term. But what is God's kind of love like? What's its major characteristic?
Unconditional.
it isn't a feeling or an emotion. It's a verb of action or activity. What does it mean? It means doing the things that will bring out the best in and for the objects of love. The one you love, agape love, means you do for or do with that person whatever will bring the best in and for them. Tough love in our day is a term that sometimes lines up against that. There are things that might look to a casual observer as if those are things that might imply you don't love somebody, but you're still looking for their long-term good. It's that kind of love. Love that's active and takes action, not love that's just an emotion or a feeling. Okay? And then there's two more. This is in verse 20. I will betroth you to myself in, mine says, loyalty, a word I don't think is quite as good as what you have in your translations. And then, and in knowledge of God. Now, let me deal with this one first. I know some of you will have translations that when you get to this point, it looks like you have five of these things, and then it switches and says, and you will acknowledge me as God. That, I'm told, is really just a difference in structure, that if you want to have this parallel, this would be the way to say that. And we'll stay with that. What other terms do you have here? Because I remember there's one of those.
Faithfulness.
Anything else? Okay. Now, I want to circle three of those six, and I want to make this assertion. And the assertion is, if you look at those three, those are the foundation on which God can build a relationship with His people. And these things are things that flow out of that. These three are the foundation. And if those are in place, then tenderness and compassion and mercy towards other people flows out of that. Righteousness and justice, goodness and fairness, those flow out of that. These three are foundational. In your relationship with God, these three become foundational. And then from that, other things flow. And I've got a reason for asserting that. But I'm going to wait just 1 minute. If all that goes in place, and you have the foundation for and the fruits of a relationship with God, what does God say in the very next verse? This is still the tail end of that section. It's verse 21 in your translation. What does God say? I will respond. You will know of me and my activity in your day. Good bit of the sermon you can lay alongside this. You want to see some more miracles? Let God open your eyes a little bit and you start to see some things. I will respond. I will respond. I will respond. Five times he says it there. I will respond. Okay? Now, go to chapter 4. I'm going to read the first phrase of verse 1, and I want you to tell me whether your translation lines up with this or not. People of Israel, the prophet says, hear what the Lord has to say. For the Lord indicts the citizens of the country. What verb does yours use at that point? Charges. Indicts, places charges against.
Has a controversy.
Has a controversy. I think one translation says lays out a case against. Okay. Now, let's stick with indictment for a moment or two. What does an indictment have to have in it? Statement of charges. God makes two charges against the people of Israel in the verses that follow, in the rest of this verse and the verses that follow. See if you can hear what they are. People of Israel, hear what the Lord says, for the Lord indicts the citizens of the country, and mine has a colon at that point. There is no faithfulness, no faithful love, no knowledge of God in the country. What's indictment charge number one? Some things that ought to be there, in particular these three, that are the foundation for any right relationship with God, those three things are missing from the country. They might be there in this person or that person, but there's going to be very few, and there's no connected, there's no grouping. So, indictment charge number one is, there's some things that ought to be there, and they're not. What's the rest of the charge? What's charge number two? Verse 2. Here's what is present in the country. What is it?
My first word, I've got six words or six terms and then a comment.
At least that's the way I read this.
The first word I have is perjury. And the second word I have is lying. I think somebody said swearing or cursing. Lying, I think, is the second word that I have. I think you're going to have two words there. One of those words will be one of these, and then the second word will be this one, I think. Are there any other terms that we ought to get up here? This is the idea of reading it more than one translation. We'll try to see some details. There's one translation out there that the first hour gave that had something a little bit different. You have that, help me show it. Anybody?
Just murder.
No, that's further down the list. That's further down the list. Okay. Somebody said using God's name wrongly. That's not exactly the way they said it, but it's pretty close. That is, the way they talked about swearing, maybe this was in the Amplified Bible that they put that in, was to take the Lord's name in vain, was to use the Lord's name wrongly. Or to use God's name to curse somebody. But this one back here talks about perjury, and that seems to be a very different word. So maybe that word is a variation on this one in my translation. In any event, there's at least two thoughts hiding there. What's the next two words?
Murder.
Any other words for that one?
Killing.
And what's the next one? Stealing. Mine says theft. Yours says stealing. Anything else? That's the next word. That's not one of those. We got sort of dividing them up again. There's six things here. Now, what's the last two? Adultery.
And what's the last one?
Yeah, mine says violence. Another translation says break all bounds. A different one says break all the rules.
Sheer anarchy.
That's the comment that I see on mine. Bloodshed on bloodshed, bloodshed follows bloodshed. That looks to me like comment, but maybe it's a variation on that. Bloodshed on or follows. What's the first indictment?
What's the first indictment? The first charge of the indictment. There are things that should be in place in the country if there's going to be a right relationship with me, and they aren't there. What's the second charge? Uh-oh. Have you lost it? There are things that are there that shouldn't be there. What are the things that ought to be there that aren't? These things on which a good relationship with the Lord is based. What are the things that are there that shouldn't be there? These things. Here's my question. Look at that group of things and tell me if you've ever seen a list that contained most of those. You ever seen a list that contains most of those? The last six of the Ten Commandments. You'll find those in Exodus 20 or in Deuteronomy 5. Deuteronomy 5 is slightly easier to see it. Most of the time when I look at those and I start counting, I get to 11 or 12 because it's not clear how they combine particular ones. And I haven't gone back to double check that. But how are the Ten Commandments constructed? Do you remember? Four of the Ten Commandments apply to our relationship with God. And the last
six apply to our relationship with each other. Right? That list over there is almost a repeating of those last six. Not quite, but almost. Murder, theft, perjury, bearing false witness, adultery, those line up almost perfectly. Covetousness might very well lead to some of these things. Where does all the violence around you come from? One of Paul's epistles said. Comes from your greed. You want things, you don't have them, so you go out and you fight. So, you know, maybe that, if those don't line up perfectly, they come pretty close to lining up. So what's the indictment in total? The indictment in total is you're ignoring the most basic commandments that I gave you. A proper relationship with me is where the Ten Commandments start. And you haven't begun to put in place any of the things on which a right relationship with me is set. And you've done all the things I told you not to do. No murder, you're murdering. No theft, you're stealing from each other all the time. And on. And what's the conclusion? Look at the first phrase of verse 3. My translation says, this is why. Your translation may say, therefore. Because of this, yours says. What's the rest of the sentence? The land is in mourning. Mine says, the country is in mourning and all of its citizens are pining away. Even wild animals and birds of the sky and fish of the sea will disappear. Yeah.
An interesting commentary on that. And we were listening to the news this week, and they were talking about Katrina and New Orleans and so forth. And one of the comments that one of the people made down there about all the devastation a year later was that it was silence. There were no birds returning to the area.
I talked to somebody this week. We had a dinner at the university that I went to, and there was a person who had lived for a good part of life somewhere in California and said, I love living in Virginia. I step out my back door and I hear nature. The tree frogs and the cicadas and
all the things that keep you from sleeping at night because they're so loud that you want to shut your door and turn on the air conditioner, right? She loved those. You're right. What's missing? Faithfulness, faithful love, and what? Knowledge of God. Go to verse 6. What's the first phrase? My people perish, are destroyed, because they don't have a knowledge. Not, what kind of knowledge? Knowledge of God. Okay? Now, where are they supposed to have gotten this knowledge of God? Well, if you look at the verses between where we left off in verse 3 and where we pick back up in verse 6, it says, you know, the people are guilty. This is verse 4. I'm paraphrasing a little bit because it's not worded in a way that really illuminates what it's trying to say. You hear the prophet saying God's words, but don't let anyone denounce or rebuke. And what's implied is the people. Next line. It is you, priest, that I denounce. Priest, you will stumble in broad daylight, and the prophet will stumble with you in the dark. Criticism is coming to the religious leaders, because the religious leaders have not done their job. Coming through here, there's a sense that he says there is guilt here, and the guilt is enough to bring destruction. But the guilt of the people is smaller than the guilt of the people who are the leaders. The leaders haven't done their job. Why should the people be guilty at all if they've been misled? Chew on that one for a minute as we move forward. Okay? Look at verse 6 again. My people perish for want of knowledge, since you, that is priests, have yourselves rejected knowledge, so I will reject you from my priesthood. Since you, priests, have forgotten the teaching of your God, I in my turn will forget your children, the ones you teach. The more of them, the more priests there have been, the more they have sinned against me. They have, how does verse 7 finish? What have they done?
Exchanged what? Their glory. Is glory capitalized for you?
Yes.
Yes.
For what?
Shame.
Something disgraceful. I am told that in Hebrew that equates to a play on words for Baal.
For false gods, for things that are not God. Now, I want to take you two places real quickly. First of all, I want you to look back at verse 6. You have yourself rejected knowledge, therefore I reject you. You have forgotten my teachings, therefore I will forget you and your children. You see that? I want you to go for just a minute. Don't lose your place in Hosea, but I want you to go to Romans chapter 1. You got the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, then Acts, then Romans. So it's the first of the letters of Paul. Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. I'm going to start reading at verse 18. Read along with me. The wrath or retribution of God from heaven is being revealed against the ungodliness and injustice of human beings who in their injustice hold back truth. For what could be known about God is perfectly plain to them, since God has made it plain to them. Ever since the creation of the world, the invisible existence of God and His everlasting power have been clearly seen by the mind's understanding of created things, and so these people have no excuse. They knew God, and yet they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him. But their arguments became futile, and their uncomprehending minds were darkened. While they claimed to be wise, in fact, they were growing so stupid that they did something. What did they do? Exchanged the glory of the immortal one for images, one translation says, imitations, another translation says, for the image of a mortal human being or birds or animals or crawling things. Does your next verse start with the phrase, that is why, or this is why, or therefore? What did God do? Gave them up or gave them over. Your translation say, mine says simply this, God abandoned them. Look at verse 26. What does it say? God abandoned them. Look at verse 28, tail end of the, or middle of the verse. Verse 28, since they would not consent to acknowledge God, that was the other translation of that phrase that we saw earlier, God abandoned them. That thought in Romans had its origin much, much earlier. Hosea echoes that same thought. I want to take you a second place. Don't lose Hosea, but go to Jeremiah. Jeremiah is the second of the major prophets, so that means you've got to move back towards Psalms about four books. Find Jeremiah and find chapter 2. Started a little bit later than this in the first hour. I want to start a little earlier with you so you can see a little bit more of the context. So start with me in verse 4. Jeremiah chapter 2, start with me in verse 4. Listen to the Lord's words, house of Jacob, and all the families of the house of Israel. The Lord says this, what did your ancestors find so wrong in me for them to have deserted me so far as to follow futility and to become futile themselves? They never said, where is the Lord who brought us out of Egypt and led us through the desert, through a land of plains and ravines, through a land of drought and shadow, dark as death, a land no one passes through and where no human being can live. I brought you to a country of plenty to enjoy its produce and good things, but when you entered, you defiled my country and made my heritage loathsome. The priests never asked, where is the Lord? Those skilled in the law did not know me. those, even the shepherds rebelled against me, and the prophets prophesied by Baal and followed the useless ones. So I must state my case against you. This is another way of stating the indictment, the Lord declares. And state my case against your children's children. Cross to the isles of Kittim, look to Kedar, and carefully observe. See if anything like this has happened before. Now here's the phrase I'm coming to. Does any nation change its gods? And these aren't gods at all. Yet my people have exchanged their glory for the useless one. The heavens stand aghast at this, horrified, utterly appalled. The Lord declares, for my people have committed two crimes. They have abandoned me, the fountain of living water, and have dug water tanks for themselves, cracked water tanks that can hold no water. Okay, we're almost through. But what I want to do now is I want to take you back to chapter 4 and I want to show you. He says something about the priests, but in the process he says something about the people. So let me talk about the priests first. You rejected knowledge of me, I reject you. You forgot my teachings, so I'll forget your children.
The priests no longer teach the truth. The priests are no longer teaching the truth. Why don't people know what they need to know? The priests aren't teaching anymore.
The more of them there have been, the more they sinned against me. What have the priests been doing?
They don't teach the truth. They don't live the truth. They're not living in the light of what they ought to know. They're living in opposition to that.
They bartered their glory for shame.
Why would somebody do that? If God is powerful and those idols are impotent, why would anyone make that exchange? There can only be one reason. And Jesus expressed it on the cross as one of the last things he said. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. The priests no longer teach the truth. They no longer live the truth. They no longer recognize truth.
They no longer live it. They no longer teach it. They no longer recognize it. Come over to verse 12.
When the priests don't know what to do, what do they do?
Verse 12. Hosea chapter 4, verse 12.
What do the priests do?
They consult their idols. Let me tell you what my translation says. They consult their block of wood and their stick explains what they should do. Tea leaves. Mm-hmm. Chicken entrails.
The message says they ask questions of a dead tree and expect answers from a sturdy walking stick.
How do we word that so that it's parallel with this? Here's my attempt. The priests no longer accept the truth. Because they're looking for truth in all kinds of places, and if they understood the truth and accepted the truth, they'd realize that that was silly and ridiculous.
So what's the conclusion? Look at verse 14 and look at the last phrase in verse 14. A people with no understanding. What? Yours says are ruined, will come to ruin. Mine says are doomed. Verse 15 of chapter 5. No, let me go to chapter 5, verse 3 for just a minute. Look at the last phrase of chapter 5, verse 3. Does yours have something like mine? Israel is defiled. Isn't that a great word? What does yours say?
Defiled,
corrupt,
polluted.
Okay, great words. Verse 6, though they go in search of the Lord with their sheep and cattle, they will not find him. He has withdrawn from them. Why would they go in search of the Lord with their sheep and their cattle? What's that a reference to?
Sacrifice.
You're killing animals, but you don't know what you're doing with it. Verse 15, still in chapter 5, I'll go back to my place until they confess their guilt and seek me. Seek me eagerly in their distress. Now, if you've got a pen that doesn't bleed through the page, put a big line before chapter 6, verse 1. Because chapter 6, verse 1 is the words of the person or group that says, you know, God is right. We do need to return to Him. Listen to the words. Come, let us return to the Lord. He has rent us. He's ripped us apart. He'll heal us. He has struck us. And he will bind up our wounds. After 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he will raise us up, and we will live in his presence. What does that sound like? What's the biggest miracle that God has ever done? The death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. In his death, we find life. And in his resurrection, we find our own. There's a couple of Bible commentators who don't think that refers to the resurrection, but there's not very many of them. You want to put another line, put it between verse 3 and verse 4, because when you get to verse 4 in chapter 6, it's right back to the theme of what it has been on. But that little bit, chapter 6, 1 through 3, that's what it sounds like if you find somebody who's repentant and ready to respond. What am I to do with you, Ephraim? What am I to do with you, Judah? For your love is like the morning mist, like a dew that quickly disappears. Verse 6 of chapter 6 is one of the most powerful verses in the Old Testament. There are approximately 55 or 60 verses so similar to it, and they all deal with the same thing. What does the Lord require of me, Micah says? And it's those three things. Faithful love is what pleases me, not sacrifice. Knowledge of God and not burnt offerings. Usually you'll find all three or at least two of these three in those verses. And there's 50 or 60 or so of them in the Old Testament, a whole bunch of echoes in the New Testament. Now, if the priests are leading the people astray, why are the people still guilty? Well, let me just give you two references and I'll let you look at them later. One is in Deuteronomy 18. Don't go look it up because I don't think we have time. But in Deuteronomy 18, God says, you know, the people have said something important. When they were standing at the foot of the mountain shook and God's voice came and they said, we've got to have somebody stand between us and God. And right now that's Moses. But the day's going to come when Moses isn't here. So when that day comes, God give us somebody else. And God says to Moses in Deuteronomy 18, they have said well, so from them, from their own brothers, I will raise up a person like you. And then the words that follow are the words about Jesus. You listen to him. I'm sorry. You don't get to go there, but I do. Because remember I told you there were going to be about 15 lists this morning? I want you to hear this one. From their own brothers, this is verse 18 of Deuteronomy 18. I will raise up a prophet like yourself. I will put my words into his mouth and he will tell them everything I command him. Anyone who refuses to listen to my words spoken by him in my name will have to render to me an account. Three verses later it says, you know, you may be privately wondering, this is a quote, you may be privately wondering, how are we to tell whether a prophet speaks for God or doesn't? And the answer is, if he says something's going to happen and it doesn't happen, don't listen to him. But that's not the only test. There's another test back in Deuteronomy 13. You go to 13, chapter 13, verse 1. Write that down. You can look at it later. It says, if a prophet or dreamer of dreams arises among you, offering some sign or wonder, and the sign or wonder comes about, what's happened so far? He passed test 1, right? If he then says to you, Let us follow other gods hitherto unknown to you and serve them. You must not listen to that prophet's words or to that dreamer's dreams. The Lord your God is testing you to know if you love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. The Lord your God is the one you must follow. Him you must fear. To him, to his commandments you must keep. His voice you must obey. Him you must serve. To him you must hold fast. There went another list if you heard it. The fact that a leader says some things that turn out to be right doesn't make that leader worth following. These people had leaders that weren't worth following, but they hadn't applied the second test, and so they're still guilty. Every new religious movement catches them up. They seek guidance from all the wrong places, making life and death decisions based on advice from things that are ignorant or inarticulate. They go through religious rituals, but they also do all sorts of evil things on the side, and they never see the conflict. And they teach their children it really doesn't matter who you worship. How do you build a right relationship with God?
You put in place a foundation, and out of that foundation flows all the other things. And if that's not happening, you're in trouble.
Back in 2 Chronicles chapter 7, it gives the recipe. If you see everything in the world around you falling apart, and you want to see it change, what do? Do you go and try to fix all the things that are wrong in the world? God says, if my people who are called by my name, what's the first thing? Humble themselves. Seek my face and pray. Then I'll hear. And I'll heal their land. Hosea was in a land where it was falling apart.
Back here on murder and killing, there was one translation that had another word. The word was assassination. They had 17 kings, I think it was, in Israel, who were assassinated right after this time. All the kings from this point on, they could be there for 6 months or 8 months and somebody killed them. It just all was falling apart. Didn't know it when Hosea was speaking, but it came soon.
How much of this applies to us, I don't know. But enough that it makes me take notice, and I hope it does you too. Your assignment for this week, if you haven't read Hosea in two translations, go find another translation, read it that way. Come back next week, we'll talk a little bit more. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank you for the time you give us. We thank you for the words that we've been led to read today. And I pray that today you would bring change in our hearts to where we hear you more clearly and follow you more closely. Because your love has come alive in our hearts. Help us listen to our leaders, but always listen to you as we listen to our leaders. Keep us close to you. Keep us close to each other. We pray these things in your Son's name. Amen.